Hey there, podcast family. T-Bone here to talk about the 3D Dentist Digital Implant Continuum. Are you ready to start placing dental implants, but feeling a bit hesitant and or overwhelmed? I know that feeling. I've been there. Let's change that together. Imagine not just learning about dental implants in a classroom, but actually performing surgeries on real patients right here in North Carolina, guided every step of the way by our expert 3D mentors. This is dental implant learning at its best, using techniques that are safe, predictable, and confidence-boosting. They're exactly what I use in my own practice, so you know they work. Our course goes beyond clinical skills. We prepare you to successfully integrate high-demand implant services into your practice, transforming your career by attracting new patients and elevating your practice. And it doesn't end with the course. Completing our program is just the beginning of a new journey. You'll be a part of a community of confident, skilled dentists with ongoing support to ensure lasting success and growth. After all, this is about mastering a skill that can transform your career, just like it did for me. So, are you ready to take your practice to the next level? Visit www.3d-dentist.com, check out our upcoming sessions, and join us to revolutionize your practice. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now let's get back to this week's episode.
Welcome to T-Bone Speaks with Dr. Tarun Agarwal, where our goal is to change the way you practice dentistry by helping you achieve clinical, financial, and personal balance. Now, here's your host, T-Bone.
All right, everybody, welcome back for another episode of our podcast. And before we get started today, I want to remind everybody to take an opportunity to leave a review for us on iTunes. I still haven't hit my goal of the number of views we want to get. And then secondarily, we love to hear feedback and questions from you by visiting tbonespeaks.com. And you can leave either a audio or text question. Today, I'm happy to have a wonderful guest who doesn't open his eyes very wide on a podcast. And Dr. John Yu is a dentist in, why else would he be on here? But he's a dentist in Tucson, spelled Tucson, Arizona. So, John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. How are you?
So far, so good. I don't know how well you're doing personally.
Well, as well as I can be. It's a new year, so very excited.
Don't your people celebrate New Year's at another time?
That is true. There is a Chinese New Year, which I believe the Koreans celebrate at the same time.
Do they really?
Yes, I believe so. Actually, I'm not sure when the exact date is, which is kind of sad, but.
Are you even Korean? Like, are your parents? Do your parents like claim you? Are they proud of you?
Yeah. Well, they've always raised me that I am Korean, but at the same time, I am an American. So, since I do live here in the States, so they are very proud of proud of American heritage.
Yeah, it's interesting. My parents say we fail. On occasion, they're like, we failed. You have become too American. You've become, not Indian and stuff. And I'm like, you left India in the 1970s, and India is not the 1970s India that you left, So they live standing still in time, and we're no longer in time. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah. I always wonder if my parents never immigrated here, what I would have become if I was still in Korea.
Well, you might be Kim Jong-il or something like that.
as well be. Yeah, you're right.
There's no question. Can you imagine how many dry cleaning stores there must be in Korea?
There's probably a ton. I think that's all they do.
But that's all they do here in the U.S. So, if every Korean owns a dry cleaner here, just the whole country of Korea must be dry cleaning stores.
That's their economy.
It is.
Everyone gets their clothes dry cleaned.
Everybody's got press start shirts all the time.
They don't even own washer and dryers. They don't even sell washer and dryers. That's all they do.
That's interesting. Well, enough stereotypical jokes. I'll probably get some comments about that. But let's talk about who is John Yu. Tell our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, well, I am a dentist, as you mentioned. That's why I'm on the show. I graduated dental school in 2007 from the University of Washington. a proud Husky. I was actually at the University of Washington also for undergrad. So I was there for 8 years. And actually, I just...
Did you guys get a deal? Buy 4 years, get 4 years free?
I wish it was that easy. But yeah, I'm a proud Husky. I was actually just at the Peach Bowl in Atlanta where we got our butts rocked by Alabama. But, you know, we scored the first touchdown, which was nice to see. And then after that, just got shut out the rest of the game.
I mean, at least you can go home with that, right?
Yeah. So I've been practicing since 2007. Immediately after graduation, I moved to Tucson, Arizona, where I practice in a suburb called Oro Valley. It's a northwest suburb of Tucson. I purchased an existing practice in 2009. But before that, I did work at a corporation for 6 months and then worked for another dentist as an associate for a year before I purchased the practice that I'm at. And it's a solo practice, so I'm the only doctor. And just recently, this past August, I relocated just literally 50 yards away since we were outgrowing our old space. So it's a blessing to be in our new space. It's blessed to see the growth of the practice. And I mean, I'm hoping tonight, you know, we can hash out some of the things that come with growth and how to manage all that.
Tell us something interesting about it. What are some of your hobbies and things?
Hobbies-wise, I am a big sports fan.
Well, I've seen you. You're not big. I mean, you're pretty typical Asian. You can't be more than Asian, 5 feet tall. Yeah. You can't be more than 5 foot tall.
Actually, I'm pretty tall for a Korean now. yeah, so I'm a big sports fan. College basketball. You know, I love college sports, college basketball.
You're an Arizona fan?
I am actually now an adopted U of A Wildcat fan, basketball at least. I mean, that's the culture down here. That's the only thing going for Tucson. But I mean, this place is a beautiful city regardless. But
no, you guys have that the stargazing thing over there.
We do. There's tons of observatories.
Yeah, yeah.
Out here, one of the more popular ones is called Kitt Peak.
Yeah, I went there. It's like an hour and a half away or so.
Yeah, about an hour and a half west of Tucson. But literally in Tucson, there's no streetlights. The only streetlights exist at the intersections. After that, everything else is dark, and all the plazas have restrictions and codes on how long the storefront lights can be on and such, because there's tons of retired people here as well. So a lot of them own telescopes. So they try to keep any sort of light from glaring into the sky that would prevent any sort of stargazing, star viewing, anything like that.
That's interesting. So so you enjoy college basketball?
I do.
What, you play any golf? Yeah,
actually, I don't play much golf, sad to say.
So I mean, I thought you Koreans are all into golf now. Well, that's just lady Koreans.
Those are the lady Koreans. I'm not sure how many of the male Koreans are actually doing pretty well, but some of my favorite players used to be like Anthony Kim. I know
Kim. Anthony Kim, that guy just dropped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, yeah, he got injured. I think he.
That's lying. He got his money from Nike and left.
which is a sweet deal. And then, you know, KJ Choi, he's done pretty well for himself. There's Y.E. Yang who beat Tiger Woods once. So there's some Koreans who've done very well, and I think there's still some up-and-comers. But yeah, but overall, yeah, I don't play much golf. I'm not very patient to set aside 5 hours of just looking for golf balls.
Well, I mean, I don't look for my minor in the middle of the fairway. In fact, I played golf for the first time with my son in almost a year and a quarter today. We just gotten busy, and I got a little too focused on my business and all of those things. And it was quite eye-opening to get out there with him today and see that he still has that love for the game and everything. It was awesome.
I guess it's a good way to pass time with, you know, with your son. I think that's the, you know, to stir up conversation and all that, spend time together.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, he's only 10. He doesn't really like to talk to me. So most people say that stage hits when you're 13 or 14. But when you're Indians, you do everything faster. You know, we become doctors by the time we're 16. So by the time we're 10, we don't talk to our parents anymore. All right, talk to us about your practice. I mean, tell us, what kind of practice do you have? I mean, insurance, no insurance, solo, group?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a solo practitioner. Currently speaking, grown now to myself and 8 employees. So I have 2 full-time front office, 1 part-time front office. I have 2 full-time assistants, 1 full-time hygienist, and 2 part-time hygienists, which makes up essentially a full-time hygienist. We are
so you're a staff of, sorry, 6.5 full-timers essentially.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah. Equivalent of 6.5 peoples.
Yes.
Okay.
We are contracted with PPOs. We're contracted with 10 PPOs.
Why so many?
That's the way that we've always operated.
But was it like that? I remember you mentioned you bought a practice.
Yes. So when I purchased the practice, we actually were contracted with less. I believe it was like 7, but after I purchased the practice, I just...
But you bought in 2009. I mean, that was a downtime in the economy, especially in Arizona.
Yes. So I signed on with three more just in the hopes of growth. But yeah, we're contract with 10 PPOs. I would say in terms of percentage-wise, PPO to fee-for-service patients, I would say it's around 70-30. Because we do have a lot of retired patients, a lot of snowbirds, who are insurance-free. And the average age of my patient population would have to fall in the range of 55 to 65 years old, which is actually, I mean, I didn't intentionally buy this practice because of that, but in hindsight, I would say that was a blessing in disguise, just in that they live by a schedule, you know, they're very committed, you know, they show up on time for their dental appointments. So we haven't had a huge issue or problem with no-shows or cancellations. Relatively, I think we're better in terms of that than the average office simply because of our age demographic.
Oh, I was thought you were going to say it's more because of some systems or something you have.
Yeah, you know, we do have systems in place that are good, but I would say, I don't know, I think the older population, they're just more committed to showing up to appointments.
They're old-fashioned.
Yeah, they're old-fashioned, exactly. Yeah. Whereas the younger crowd or even the millennials, you know, they just kind of run on their own time, their own show, so...
So, okay, so you're currently by yourself, the only dentist. You guys take almost 10 PPOs. I mean, is this what you wanted of your practice? I mean, are you happy with it? I mean, did you set aside to have this? Are you taking so many insurances in the attempt to bring somebody else in? I mean, what's your goal there?
Yeah.
Or are you just like me where you just do things and see if it works?
I guess a lot of dentistry so far in the last – I've been at my practice now for 8 years – in the last 8 years has sort of been trial and error, really. I've never hired a consulting firm. That's something that I am now considering, trying to analyze all the numbers and metrics in my office. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if it's just because I've been oblivious or just naive, but I know that things have sort of worked out. And, you know, someone told me prior to buying my practice that my practice will look like this, then I would consider it still successful. But I do know that with success, whether you have a PPO heavy office or a fee for service office, there are different stresses. And I guess sort of my stresses have been just managing growth. Is it right to say no to new patients, or is it right to?
It's never right to say no to new patients. I mean, it's right to say no to some patients once you meet them, maybe, or meet them on the phone, but it's never right to say no. At least in my opinion, it's not right to say no to business.
Some other questions is like, you know, is it time now to cut away insurance plans? But then the way I look at it, so let me tell you some of my new patient numbers first before I kind of get into all that. So as I mentioned earlier, I built a new office and we moved in. Our first day was August 1st. So pre-August of 2016, from 2009 when I purchased my practice to pre-August 2016, we were averaging around 20 new patients a month. We'd have some, you know, some months as low as 10, some months as high as 30, 35, but on average about 20. Now, since we've been in the new office beginning August 2016, every month we've hit at least 38 new patients, as high as 42. So we've been averaging in that range about 40 new patients. So
what makes that happen?
I think it's simply visibility, because we have not done any external marketing. I mean, obviously patients are excited too because it's a new office, but they come in and they're wowed by just the new culture, because I think first impression.
Are they wowed by seeing a Korean?
Well, you know, they've always been pleased with, you know, with my appearance and all that. But,
let's not be narcissistic or anything.
They've been pleased with the services they've received, hopefully, and you know, they referred and invited other patients to the practice. But I think there's something to be said about location. And, you know, we literally, like I said, just moved 50 yards away, but for some reason now we're more visible.
So is that 50 yards like forward towards the street, or what's changed?
Towards the street. Yes.
So what were you in before? What kind of location were you in?
We're in a more of an upscale strip mall, but in the strip mall, there's three separate sort of freestanding buildings.
So you're in the same strip mall?
I'm actually in the smallest building that only has three units.
But in the same little shopping center.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's correct. But that three-unit building is the closest to the street.
Okay. So it's like an outparcel.
Yeah. And then within the strip mall, there's a road that runs between my three-unit building now and the rest of the strip mall. So on the corner space within that three-unit strip mall. or this three-unit building, rather.
Okay, so you've got double visibility, essentially.
Yes. I mean, patients who have shopped, you know, in the plaza, who have banked at the Bank of America in there, who have done other things, they thought we were totally new to the plaza. They had no idea that we were even in the plaza all these years. So it's,
and you've been there 8 years. Now, when you bought the practice, was it there?
It was there for 7 years prior to that.
Okay, so 15 years it's been there. Your old space was how big?
1,300 square feet. Our new space is 2,350.
Was your rent per foot the same?
Yes. So my rent at my new office, pretty much it went up every year a certain percentage. But where we ended at, my new rent at my new place is lower than where we ended at my old place.
Even for double the space?
Exactly. So we locked in a pretty good deal, and my rate doesn't go up for another five. Actually, I locked it in for 5 years.
So if you don't mind me asking, okay, because yes. I want to understand what you're saying. I want to make sure you're not doing Asian mathematics on me, okay? So what were you paying in rent for your 1,300 square feet before?
I was paying $3,800.
For 1,300 square feet, and you didn't negotiate that lease. That lease was negotiated for you?
Yes.
Okay. And you're paying how much now for your new 2350?
3,300.
So actually you're saving $500 a month by moving.
Yeah, and actually I'm incorrect on one part. So it's $3,300 for the first 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then from month 19 all the way through month 60, it's the same rent. My rent's going to go up actually $800. That was just built in to be a rent reduction. That was part of the negotiation.
So 41
will be $4,100 from month 19.
Yeah, but nonetheless, it's effectively the same rent.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's been great. I can't complain.
Now, is your old office and your new office look very different? I mean, is your new office much more modern and fancy looking?
It's night and day. I mean, my old office, I would cringe when I walk in just because everything was so, I mean, everything was not, there was no brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing really matched. You know, I had to work with what I had to do, you know, with the previous dentist decorating it and all that. But with my new office, you know, all the design work was chosen, you know, by me, you know, working with an architect and a construction company out here.
I want to kind of go on a tangent here. What made you decide that you needed to build a new place? Were you solely looking to increase visibility?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, podcast family, T-Bone here. Are you a dentist looking to elevate your practice and profits? Then pay close attention. Introducing the 3D Business Mastermind, the dental business coaching program designed for dentists who want to see real results. I've walked the path of practice ownership for nearly 25 years. I know your challenges. I felt your pain. This is your opportunity to overcome the chaos, the busyness, and the financial frustrations of owning a dental practice. Imagine a dental practice where your appointment book is highly productive, doing the dentistry you enjoy, your team is self-motivated, and your profits keep climbing. That's what the 3D Business Mastermind is all about. In this exclusive mastermind, you'll join a league of ambitious dentists driven to elevate their practices. You'll gain access to proven strategies, personalized coaching, and a community that understands your journey. So if you're ready to supercharge your dental practice and enjoy the success you deserve, visit www.3d-dentists.com and take the first step towards a brighter future in dentistry by filling out the 3D Business Mastermind application. Now, let's get to this week's episode.
No, actually, that wasn't even on my radar. The main thing was, I was at a point where we were just outgrowing the space. So in that 1,300 square feet, it was myself and 7 employees. So there were some days, 2 days a week, I have a 4-day work week where all 8 of us, so the 7 employees plus myself, in that cramped 1,300 square foot place.
That's like living in India.
It just wasn't working out. And our reception area was very small. So if we had, on the days where of double hygiene plus, so it was a 4-op office. So if we had patients for all 4 ops and they brought like kids or a family member to wait in the reception area, I mean, there was not enough chairs. Some people had to wait outside.
Oh my God. You're like a denture clinic. We have a lineup of people. But that's good for business. You should put some velvet ropes out there.
Yeah, and then maybe a strobe light too.
Yeah, exactly. To have a bouncer to check IDs and stuff.
So we had to manage the growth was essentially the bottom line.
Okay.
Manage the office growth as well as patient growth.
And you were lucky to find a place in the same shop as her. That's nice.
Yes, yeah, that was huge. If it was an ideal world, if it was my dream, then I wish I can own my own building, build from ground up. But I was just taking over another shell, and I'm still paying for rent. So, but I think at the end of the day, again, you know, it's location, location, location.
Yeah, so I'm fortunate that I can own my building and have a great location, but that costs an arm and a leg to have the building I have. And you've been there. So, most business people will tell you there's nothing really wrong in renting from a pure business perspective. Number one, it's 100% taxed write-off. And then number two, it gives you flexibility to move like you were able to do. Now, imagine if you owned that 1,300 square feet and you wanted to move. You'd have to find a buyer for that and hopefully be able to sell it for what you bought it for or more, and then be able to move. So there's a lot of pluses and minuses to renting. Now, like you say, I don't want to rent, especially as a dentist, if we're going to be in a place long-term. But at the same time, I think sometimes by being in a visible location, you'll make over what you save there. I mean, it's negligible in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
So how did you decide how you wanted to design your office? I mean, did you enlist your dental specialist or, sorry, your dental supply?
No, so 3 years ago, I was in the middle of a five-year lease that I extended. So I knew that at the end of the five-year lease, I really had to think hard if I need to renew for another couple of years in that 1,300 square foot. But I did not want to, number one, because of the landlord. He wasn't really a good landlord. But number two, I wasn't sure if that would have been a wise move just with the growth of the office. So concerning that, I attended a sort of office design seminar. I believe it's at Benco.
Okay. Oh, God.
Yes, yeah, so Benco. Center Point. So I'm not a Benco customer, but one of my my old Patterson rep switched to Benco, so he knew that I was redesigning the office. Like, he just invited me to go out there just for the office.
So that's in Pennsylvania, right?
They have one in Pennsylvania, and they also have one out in Costa Mesa, California.
Okay.
So went out there, learned a ton. It was great because the guy who teaches, his name is Dr. Mark Tholen, just kind of teaches sort of basics on what to look for, how to design an office. In a dental office, there's really three zones. You have sort of the front office zone, you have the clinical zone, and then you have the staff zone. So you should never have like your staff lounge, right next to the front office area. You should never have the patient, like your doctor's private office right next to the front office area. So like the staff zone would be in the way back. And what that would include is the staff lounge, private office, any staff bathroom, things like that. That way.
I gave my team members a outhouse, a porta potty.
That's perfect. Yeah. So learned a lot from there. And when I met a dental architect out here in Arizona, in his initial proposal that he gave me for the office design, had all the sort of the philosophies that were taught at that course. So I knew that this dental architect knew what he was doing. Whereas when Patterson drew me up a floor plan, it was just terrible. They put 18 chairs in my front office, or my reception area. It made no sense. There was no formula. They just kind of drew in what they what they thought was.
Well, a lot of times these guys drew you templates to just get started, and then from there you nitpick it and adjust it and cut and paste it and slice and dice it. So yeah, a lot of times that's really what they do. They start from a base model and then kind of go from there. So okay.
So that's where we started. And then, the rest is sort of, construction company. I use the dental, exclusive dental only construction company. They're based out of Phoenix. The name of the company is actually called Denco. It stands for dental construction, but they did an excellent job. They use great contractors, who know plumbing, who know, all the other things that are very important to a dental office. So we haven't had any issues and everything went very smoothly.
All right, how many operatories did you have in 1,300 square feet?
Yeah, we had four operatories. In my new office, we have six, but right now I only have five equipped. Oh, okay. The sixth one only needs a chair and a computer.
So you've essentially increased capacity by 50% chair-wise.
Exactly.
That's good. Okay, so.
And then some of the other things that I definitely wanted in my new office. So we have a consultation room now, which we didn't have before. The staff have a bigger lounge, their own restroom. And then in my private office, I also have my own bathroom with a shower since I live 2 minutes away. I'm hoping to ride my bike to work, but we'll see. Yeah, it hasn't happened yet. So
is that a liberal thing? Like you want to be liberal and a tree hugger and you want to avoid using your car very much?
Well, I thought it would be a good way to kind of kill two birds with one stone. It would be my commute to work, but also my exercise.
It's interesting you said something about a consult room, and I think it's honestly probably one of the most important rooms in a practice, you know, non-clinical room, let's say, because it amazes me how many offices don't have a consult room. So for anybody listening, if your office doesn't have a consultation room and you have a private office, get rid of the private office and find a way to turn it into a consultation room. And there's something really magical about a consultation room where you can sit down with patients in a non-threatening environment, where you can have that ability to take them out. You know, sometimes when you start discussing finances and different treatment plans with a patient, it can take dozens of minutes. And yeah, those minutes are keeping you from being able to turn the room over and bring your next patient in, which is one of the ways that we get behind schedule. So having that ability to take your patient into a private area. And for us, we do so much out of a consultation room. In fact, we have, we have two, we use one full time, and the second one, we don't use the way I want it to be used. And that's an area of frustration for me. But I really firmly believe that consultation rooms are critically important to a success of a practice.
Yeah, no, I am definitely a believer in a consultation room. That's why we incorporated that. And I first learned about the consultation room from Frank Spear, but I can definitely testify that in our old office, you know, where there's no consultation room, when you're having those conversations of, you know, I'm not sure what everyone's magic number is, but for me, you know, sort of $5,000 treatment plans, you know, when you're talking about it in sort of open bay, sort of open.
Yeah, even if you have walls, you still have the doors are open, generally speaking.
Exactly. And so it gets a little, you know, patients are not very, you know, comfortable or at their highest comfort level. And then when, you know, there's something to be said about if you're, whether it's yourself, the doctor, sitting in the doctor chair while the patient's in the patient chair, or even the treatment plan coordinator who may come in and sit on the doctor chair, there's still sort of that sort of superior, inferior sort of relationship appearance there.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're in the consultation room, you know, you can do more of co-leading or co sort of planning. And yeah. I can say that we've measured, so we have sort of metrics that we've been doing with that. And now we have a new patient coordinator. My office manager sort of is also our new patient coordinator. And we've sort of tracked numbers when we use the consultation room for those sort of times when we do for big treatment cases. And I can say that our closure rate is a lot higher. So I would definitely advise anyone who's building an office to definitely, yeah, you know, make a smaller private office and make a consultation room. That's huge.
You know, another thing you just reminded me of is it's interesting how dentistry kind of goes in cycles. I think that before my time, at least, dental rooms had doors on them, the operatories themselves. And then we went through this thing where we had walls in between them. Okay. And then we went through this phase where we started having this open bay concept where there was a middle cabinet. I think that was more about a way for these companies to sell us outrageously expensive cabinets.
Yeah.
And now we've gone back to almost pretty much always having walls between rooms, but they have the two non-doored entrances, correct?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. One of the things that I struggle with is our consultation room is one of our very first operatories. So anybody walking back to any of the other rooms for any treatment walks by our first operatory. And sometimes we have patients' pictures up, and sometimes we're talking about people, and you can hear people walk by and stuff. So I'm moving back towards having a few rooms that have doors, fewer operatories that have doors on them, so that you can create some privacy. Or when you have that patient that's screaming that you're taking the tooth out, or stuff like that, you know. So we're actually finding that we're moving backwards in a sense towards some of the more old-fashioned designs of things. So enough about your physical building and stuff. So let's talk about what procedures do you do in your practice? I mean, so actually, let me set the stage for this. So we've talked about your growth that you've had. Since you bought the practice 8 years ago, essentially you've needed to double space. I mean, without giving us numbers that, you know, because they're all relative, when you bought the practice to where it is now, are you up 10%, 30%, 50%, 100%? You know, where are you at in terms of revenue growth?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, podcast family. T-Bone here, bringing you our newest live patient implant training, Full Arch Express. For dentists already placing implants and ready to level up and continue building their implant practice, this is the golden ticket. We're diving deep into full arch implants, the hottest game changer in implant dentistry. In this program, we tackle both overdentures and all-on-X fixed hybrids, mastering techniques that are essential for modern, comprehensive dental care. It's about getting your hands on the tools and techniques that will replace the doubt and fear with confidence and predictability. Here's the kicker. There's live patient training right here in North Carolina. You're not just learning theories. You're in the operatory doing real work on real patient from start to finish, guided one-on-one by our expert 3D mentors. You'll learn the nuances of each approach, ensuring you can cater to a wide range of patients to maximize revenue. Speaking of revenue, with me, you know it's not just about the clinical skills. We're bringing business into this aspect too, teaching you how to integrate these advanced services profitably into your practice. So are you ready to rise up to the top in implant dentistry? Join us at the Full Arch Express. This isn't just another course, it's a career-defining leap. Head to www.3ddentist.com to enroll in our next session. 3D Dentist is truly committed to helping dentists take control of their practice, finances, and future. Now, back to this week's episode.
We've grown, I would say, almost 100%.
So doubled?
Doubled, yes.
Okay.
Since we purchased the practice.
Okay, good. So that's good. So this purchase worked out for you from a financial end, unless you paid some stupid amount for it. So,
I got a pretty good deal, but yes.
So it's worked out that way. So what procedures are you doing? And I want to talk about the growth that, not where you're at today, but how you got from 2008 to now. When you bought the practice, what kind of procedure mix did the practice have?
So when I bought the practice in January 2009, the previous doctor was a Patterson Dental client, whereas I was coming from an associateship, so I was a Henry Schein client at the time. And with the new office, you know, the dental supply companies come knocking on your door wanting you to try things. And one of the big things, obviously, with a new office purchase or whatnot is typically equipment. So my Henry Schein rep advised me or recommended I do a demo of the E4D. And the Patterson rep.
Obviously, Sarek.
Yes, Sarek. So I demoed both about 6 months into my practice. And the reason why I was also okay with demoing both was, or just checking out CAD/CAM rather, is I want to do something different, you know, set myself apart from the, you know, Dr. Smith down the street. So I tested both of them out. I fell in love with the Sarek just, you know, at the time with the reputation of Sarek.
It's a good choice. Years.
Yep, it was a great choice, you know, and in hindsight is the best choice for my practice. That piece of technology is truly the cornerstone of my practice today. And I think a lot of my growth has started from that. And with the Sarek is then what's led me in 2010, what led me to then be able to purchase Combeam. So at the time, I purchased the Sirona Compact, or the Galileo's Compact, and that greatly grew my practice in implantology. But with that, I knew I wanted to incorporate implants into my practice, being a young dentist at the time, that was a procedure I knew in future dentistry-wise, implants is going to be huge. So those two things alone have transformed my practice.
So let's talk about the Combeam. So when you bought your practice, was the previous dentist doing implant dentistry?
No. So the previous dentist was just doing regular routine bread and butter dentistry, fillings, crown and bridge. And that was essentially it.
Root canals?
She was referring out. Nothing else. No root canals.
Extractions?
No extractions. No root canals.
Okay. So if I was a patient in that practice before you bought it, I would walk in and I would be offered three services. I would be offered a hygiene service, a direct restoration, or an indirect restoration.
That's correct.
I could only get three things in your office.
That's absolutely correct.
All right. So now, okay. So I can get a hygiene. I can get a direct restoration. I can get an indirect restoration. What else can John, you do for me?
So we do obviously all the traditional dentistry with the crown and bridge, with the Sarek. We do implants.
I can get implants.
Yeah, you can get implants. We'll also do a simple and surgical extractions.
Okay, so now you're doing extractions as well.
Mm-hmm. And I don't do any more endo. I did endo the first couple of years, but you know, I was just getting busy with other things that endo didn't really bring me any joy.
Okay, I'm going to write that down because I need to talk to you about that. Okay.
And I do dentures. I'm trying to stay away from doing non-implant supported lower dentures. Mm-hmm. So
the way to stay away from that is just to tell your patients you don't do dentures without implants.
Yes.
That's so what that's we've gone of, to.
Yeah. I mean, especially the lower arch. I mean, the upper arch, I can usually make it pretty well, but
the lower arch. That's not worth the headache, honestly.
Yeah.
And orthodontics? Can I get some orthodontics?
Just Invisalign.
That's not just Invisalign. That's still orthodontics.
That is orthodontics.
Okay.
And we recently now have incorporated sleep apnea after I attended your course.
Okay. So we're going to come back to sleep. I want to, you know, that's a good way for me to plug my stuff, but that's not what I'm after right now.
Yeah.
All right. So in other words, the majority of your growth has come from adding services.
Yes.
Okay. What were your new patient numbers in 2009?
We're still averaging around 20 to 25.
Okay. So the reason I'm asking this is I'm trying to make a point. Okay. So you bought a practice that you've doubled and you didn't increase the new patient numbers necessarily on a monthly basis. Okay. So there wasn't growth in the new patient numbers when you first started. Okay. Before you moved at least. Okay. Are you following me there?
Yeah.
But yet you doubled the practice. And really what I need to get people to understand is if your practice literally offers three services, direct restoration, indirect restorations, and hygiene service, in other words, if you're just a restorative dentist, you have a ceiling on what you're going to be able to do without seeing thousands and thousands of patients. By, you know, essentially, you grew your practice not by physically growing your practice, okay? You grew your practice by just adding services to your existing patient base.
Yeah.
And I know you have new patients and all of that, but you didn't increase that until you moved. That tells me something, right? That should tell our listeners something, that the real growth doesn't come from physical growth. It comes from growth of services. So of these procedures that you're doing now, what do you like and don't like?
Well, what I like, and I guess this will go with what my long-term goals will be, but what I like and I love is if I can do more, or if I can just concentrate on CEREC dentistry, if I can concentrate just on implants, and if I can just do sleep apnea. So if I can just do those.
But you're just new to sleep, so I won't let you count that because you're not really doing it right. I mean, you're not doing a lot of it right now.
No. Okay. So yes, just those two things. If I can do more CEREC dentistry and implantology, then that would be golden for me.
Okay, great. And I'm going to write that down because I want us to come back to that as well. Okay, so, and then sleep is a new thing you do. You don't like doing Invisalign?
No, I just don't like putting on attachments. I don't like
having. Well, why are you doing it? Have your assistant do it.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I can.
I thought Asians were smart, man.
I'm a huge micromanager. That's kind of my weakness.
Well, don't be a micromanager, for God's sakes. Yeah. All right, okay. All right, so what hurdles have you faced and, you know, how have you overcome them?
Yeah, some of the hurt. Well, I'm not sure if I've totally overcome them, but
We never overcome them. I mean, we just get past them a little bit. We forget about them or something.
I think some of the hurdles is just sort of day to day operational evaluating your day to day operations.
But what does that mean to you? What do you mean by that?
Lack of better words, like metrics and statistics.
But what good are they?
I don't know. I'm not sure if other dentists do that on a daily basis.
We all talk about it, but I don't think we really know what the hell we're saying. Listen, when I talk to anybody who says they're unbelievably good at measuring their practice, 95% of them, when they tell me they're good at measuring their practice, they say, well, I know my collections and productions and my AR. And I'm like, well, that's a given. You literally can't run a practice without knowing those basic numbers. And so I think the two numbers that really matter, what comes in and what goes out. So I think beyond that, a lot of it is listen, it's important, but I think a lot of it's overhyped in terms of some of those numbers.
I mean, one of the numbers that we look at, so we have a new patient monitor. We look at how many new patients, or not just the number of new patients that come through the practice for that month, but we also look at, it's kind of itemized and it shows, you know, what their treatment plan number is. And then from that, what percent was scheduled. And obviously there's those, you know, we have those patients where it might be a $10,000 treatment plan, but they only schedule the first $2,000 because each time they come in, they're going to get appointed for the next phase or whatnot. So we're trying to look at that. But also, secondly, we also look at how many new patients in the practice for that particular month also walked out the back door for whatever reason, whether it be
the same. You mean the new patients?
No. This is existing patients. So I'm looking at.
So you're looking at patient retention of existing patients.
Exactly. So what I care about is not just the influx of new patients through a practice, but also what's the, how many people are leaving the practice?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter how many new patients you average a month. At the end of the day, are your patients staying with you?
Yeah, so, let's say you get 100 new patients a month, but you lose 200 a month. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That's not good.
Well, obviously, you're not doing that. So, I mean.
So we look at, I see death is a factor in my practice because we have a lot of old patients. But also, if they're moving out of town or maybe they simply don't like my new paint color, my new office. I don't know what they don't like. So there's different things. And so we always want to make sure that we're doing the best we can to treat our patients well, and that we're not just becoming some sort of dental mill where we're just pumping patients in and out. And I feel like that's the problem I'm having now, is because our new patient count has doubled from 20 to 40 a month. So in my practice, we spend 1 hour with a new patient. That's not just my time. That's the first 20 to 30 minutes is with the assistant. The assistant gives them a tour of the office, reviews medical history, chief concern, takes their FMX. Then I come in and I do the rest of the exam. So let's say that's an hour's time.
Do they get a cleaning?
Well, the cleaning's another hour. So
they're there for 2 hours.
Yes. So what I'm saying is that with that new patient exam, let's just consider that without the hygiene, that's 20. So in my old practice, that's 20 hours a month dedicated just to new patient exam and x-rays. Whereas in my new office now,
40
hours. Exactly.
That's a whole week. That's more than a week because you only work 4 days a week.
Exactly. That's huge. So that's sort of the problems I'm having now. And I don't know. I mean, I got to look at also my hygiene because, hygiene, we spend 1 hour with healthy patients.
Aren't all our patients healthy?
Well, PMTs or prophys are all six units of time in my office.
So wait, I'm trying to do some quick math here. So you've added essentially 20 patients a month to your hygiene outside of recalls.
Yes.
So that's the equivalent of 2 to 3 days of hygiene right there.
Yeah. So right now we have 8 days of hygiene a week currently in my office. And my office manager and I, we just had a meeting right before the
What's her name again?
Her name is Jan.
Jan, that's right.
But she and I spoke, and we need to have essentially a ninth day of hygiene added probably here very shortly, because she used to be a dental consultant before she started working for me. But so we template and we block schedule very well, because we don't want to do fillings all day, or I don't want to do fillings at all, hopefully. But in my schedule, I don't want to see just eight patients that have MODO, MODO, MODO in every quadrant. That wouldn't call for a long day, and that's unproductive. So we do have block scheduling, and even with hygiene, we schedule deep cleanings or scaling root planing rather, and we also schedule for new patient slots. So when a new patient calls, they can get a hygiene either piggyback to their new patient exam, or they can we have slots for that. But
so let me back up. Are you coordinating this new patient cluster? I mean, because so you have to schedule them in two places. You have to schedule them one in your column and two in the hygiene column. So sometimes is it a scenario where you have one available but not the other?
Exactly. So we'll usually save those certain situations where it's not piggybacked, where it's two separate days, for patients where the new patient calls and says that it's been 10 years or it's been 5 years since their last dental visit. Because the thing I don't want to run into is where we have an hour slot saved, and then when they come in for the new patient exam and they have a piggybacked hygiene.
And they have scaling or something like that.
Yeah, scaling root planing. I mean, I guess you can argue that you can start on one quad that visit, but I don't know. I mean, so those are all things I'm considering right now. That's kind of sort of what's playing through my mind these last 3 or 4 months as I've spoken with some of my friends in other cities who have had sort of similar issues.
So ultimately, what it sounds like to me, your biggest challenge, and I'm going to put words in your mouth, your biggest challenge right now is managing, I don't mean this word the way it's going to come out, but managing some of the chaos.
Yes.
Okay. And the chaos is good chaos. In other words, we've doubled our new patient intake. We've added more space, and we're obviously hopefully revenuing more to go with that. So now you're being tugged. So you're going through what I've gone through and continue to go through to a certain degree. Which is, when my practice was four or five full team members, I was at my peak. I felt not my peak, but I was just doing my best, because it was easy to lead the team because there was only four or five people. We communicated very well with each other. The practice could only have so much volume and flow. And now we're nine people. And so it's you know, we're two doctors now, but it's much more difficult to lead the practice. So you're kind of headed down that road as well. So I would say you have to kind of do two things at once, which is what you're trying to do. Is one, you need to decide. Well, I would say this first: you need to decide what direction you want to take your practice in. And then two, you need to bring on some additional help in terms of provider as a dentist in your practice. And so let's talk about deciding what way you want to go to. Let me ask you this, and I don't want to get too personal and certainly don't want to be public about it. Since your practice has doubled, have you made more money?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, but it's not like my income has doubled.
No. It never works that way, you know. Yeah, our margins, it can't work that way, okay? Because if your margin was 50%, then it would work that way, okay? But your margins typically in a practice are 25% or so, okay? So you would have, for your income to double, you have to 4X.
Yeah. So I guess to answer your question, it has increased. But here's then the question and response is that increase in income worth all the new stresses, the weight of all the stresses and headaches that come with?
It depends what you do with it. Okay, I don't mean to interrupt. I do actually, but I'm the master of interrupting. So I always talk about the three things that we're after in a practice, okay? We're after money, time, or satisfaction, okay? So let's take money off the table, because I assume you're living a good life, and if you live this life the way you are now, you'll be just happy and fine, and you'll provide for everybody in your family and so forth. So really, I would say, is it worth the headache? You know, what I would tell somebody is, you know, if you need more money because you need something in your life, then it's worth the headache. Okay. But if you don't need the money, because what the hell, what in the world are you going to spend it on? Right. So, mm-hmm. You know, I would look at it that way. So in that sense, it's not worth it. But if you look at it as, okay, growth is going to buy me time, then I would say it's worth the headache. So to give you an example, okay. So I used to take 2 to 3 weeks off a year. Okay. And in the last 8 years, the last 5 years. Okay. In the last 5 years, I've gone from taking 2 to 3 weeks off to taking 9 to 10 weeks off per year. And that has come from a couple of different ways, but an associate is paramount to that, in my opinion. Okay. So if your goal is to get more time and less stress in your office clinically, then you're going to have to add another provider to your practice.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's going to happen that I don't think enough people understand is as you want to create that satisfaction, when I mean satisfaction, that's doing the procedures you love and adding procedures to your practice, new procedures to your practice, you're going mm-hmm. to have somebody else to do the work. Okay. Because I assume you're already busy, correct?
Yeah.
If I came to your practice today, I need a crown. When am I getting it? How long?
You know, we have little slots, but yeah, I mean, probably within 2 to 3 weeks.
2 to 3 weeks, okay? I mean, that's a long time, correct?
It is.
So if I come to your office and I want to start on a veneer case, when am I getting it?
If you need it, yeah.
No, but you'll come in on Friday, Saturday, I get it, you'll stay late, do yeah, all of those things. Let's pretend you can't do those things.
Yeah, if we're doing normal day, let's say 6 veneers, a 4-hour slot, you're not coming in for at least a good 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, so to me, that's a challenge. And I know veneer cases aren't as sexy as they used to be and not as popular, but there are other procedures that take multiple hours. So as you want to move into that realm of satisfaction where you're doing more clinically advanced dentistry, you're going to have time. You're going to have a schedule that looks like Swiss cheese. So you're going to have holes so that you can plug those holes. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's some of the challenges you face. So I would say you're going to have an associate no matter what.
Yeah.
It's whether you need a full-time, part-time, and whether you need it this year or next year is really the bigger question that we need to figure out. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about profitability, okay? So you want to add a ninth day of hygiene, but are you actually profitable in hygiene? Is your average hygienist doing $1,000 a day?
Yes. So their daily goal is 1200 a day.
Okay. Are they actually doing it?
But Yeah, I mean, usually I'll say 50% of the time they do, but definitely they usually do break 1,000.
Okay. That's pretty good for a PPO practice, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, they do a very good job.
Now, how long are your days? 12 hours?
No, we do 8 hygiene patients a day.
Okay, so 8 hour day. Listen, that's better than my hygiene. My hygiene's not breaking 1,000 right now.
But so here's the thing with the PPO, just kind of talking about hygiene now. I have heard of some models where, you know, there's assisted hygiene.
Yeah, I'm totally anti-assisted hygiene, personally. Okay, yeah. I'm not saying it's wrong. I think assisted hygiene leads to bigger offices with more chaos and more running around. And it's just not the model for me, personally.
Yeah. And I'm in the same boat as you. So I just want to make that clear for myself, at least. I'm not, and again, just like what you said, I'm not against, I don't see anything negative about, but just within the realms of my, how I want to practice, I don't see that as a fit in my practice.
Yeah, I would probably consider dropping some insurance plans if I were you.
See, so that's the other thing I've considered is dropping insurance.
But why do you keep considering and not doing? No, so let me real quick, okay? So real quick, yeah. Okay? Let me say this to the audience, okay? To the audience. John is a friend, okay? So I've known John and we've had some good conversations together. And like with friendships, when you have with people, you can give them a hard time. They can give you a hard time back. So I'm totally okay with that. So when I get on John about these things, it's coming from a perspective of knowing him and liking him and having that rapport with him. So back to the beating. So why are we thinking about it and not doing it? What do you have to lose?
With the insurance topic, dropping insurances, the reason why is because I guess I'm afraid that my monthly production number, collection number would go down.
But it won't.
Because I need to maintain a certain number because obviously with a new office, there's now a new loan I have.
Yeah, I got you.
Construction and equipment and all that kind of stuff. So there's higher expenses with this new office that just comes with obviously a new build.
Okay, but there are ways around that.
Yeah, and I understand that when you drop insurances, you can also drop staff.
No, I don't want you to get rid of team member. By the staff, it's an infection. Okay, so I don't want you to get rid of. Who was the assistant that you brought here again? What was her name?
Shannon.
Is she still with you?
She is.
Okay, she's a lovely girl. We really liked her. All right, so let's go backwards here. Okay, I don't want you. I'm not trying to get rid of team members. Okay, I that's not what I'm trying to do. So think about this, okay? Generally speaking, where is your most profitable stuff from your practice?
It's going to be in quadrant dentistry and implants.
Okay, great. So where in the world does insurance help with that?
Well, it helps patients move forward because it covers some of the
yes, it does, but those insurance PPO plans...
So let me put it this way. The insurance is helped because that's how some patients find their practice.
Some patients. Yeah. But what insurance does do is it creates how many patients are you sifting through to get those? So when you're trying to manage growth, so you're going through the same thing my wife's going through, okay? In the sense that at some point she has reached her capacity in her practice, okay? In her medical practice. Yeah. So now the question is how do we grow to add the patient base that's coming in? And the question is why do you have to grow? Because you don't have to, okay? You don't have to grow both ways. I want you to grow in production and not in size. Mm-hmm. At least that's the goal, right? Our goal should be to grow in production and not in size. And what I'm seeing with insurance is that you have to grow in size to get the production. You have to. There's just no way around it, okay? With insurance. So before you go that route and you're going to take on, because you're going to take on for an associate, you're going to take on the doctor. Let's say the doctor doesn't cost you anything because they only get paid based on what they produce and collect. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're going to have auxiliary team members for that. And then you're going to have to figure out how to balance how you'll both be there at the same time and things. So I want you to keep this in mind. What I would do, okay, is I would consider dropping insurance first, because what it'll do is, and you have, I'm not the expert on this part of it. Okay. But you have to go through your plans and figure out which represents the most logical plan to get rid of. Okay. You can't get rid of your biggest one. You can't always just say, I'm going to get rid of the one that pays the least because it may be the biggest one. Okay. I mean, hopefully the one that pays the least is also your smallest one. So it's easy to get rid of, right? So you got to trim some of the fat. first, okay, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And then what will happen is your chaos will get a little bit more settled. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense.
All right. So now what are you going to do with an associate? What is that person going to help you do?
I'm hoping that the associate can do procedures that I don't do anymore.
Like so what?
One thing, endo.
Endo.
So I don't perform any root canals anymore. So I'm hoping that that's something the associate, well, that's definitely a requirement that I'm hoping to look for.
So let me ask you, back to the endo. Okay. So why don't you perform endo? Do you just break files all the time?
I just never really enjoyed endo.
Okay, so this is for me, okay? So how long between you or somebody else, but how long do you think it would take to do a good molar root canal?
How long will it take me, or will it take
a trained person? I mean, a trained person,
probably 30 minutes.
Let's call it an hour, okay? Let's call it an hour to do a molar endo, okay? So what does that pay in your practice? Or
I would say out here in Tucson for a general practice doing molar endo, $900.
The insurance companies pay $900?
Okay, let's just say $800.
$800. Okay, let's call it $800. Okay.
Easy math. Okay.
For an hour of time. Mm-hmm. How many fillings do you have to do to equal $800?
Yeah, you got to do a lot of fillings.
No, give me the number.
Probably got to do
six?
Five MODs.
Okay, and can you do that in an hour?
No, that takes probably take at least 2 hours. That'd probably be at least an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Okay, so I want you to understand where I'm coming from here, John. You want somebody to come in and do a more profitable procedure than you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I get it. It's going to add income to your practice. So that's the good part. But that doesn't buy you any time or satisfaction.
No, but then he'll be performing all the fillings that go with it. So we'll tag on that MO, those five MO.
No, come on, dude. You know that doesn't work this way, all right? I'm trying to get you to get rid of your fillings.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you get rid of fillings, what are you going to do, right? And so I'm not saying that it's wrong, okay? But I would say that it's better for you to do the endo and learn how to do endo and learn to love endo.
So here's that magical word again. I have considered doing endo again.
Okay. All right. And that's fine. But I want you to see from the business perspective, why you should do the endo. Okay. Because it's $800 an hour. Let's even call it $700 an hour. And then fillings are, you know, at your fastest, at your best, how many MODs can you do in an hour?
Probably three max.
Max, right?
Max.
Okay. So if you do three MODs max, you're looking
probably
at
two. To be honest with you, probably two to three.
Let's call it two and a half, okay? And the average MOD, I think, probably pays $150, $160, somewhere in that ballpark. All right, so that's $400 an hour. So in my opinion, there's no reason for you to bring in an associate to do endo, unless you absolutely like suck at endo, okay? or you just don't believe that you have the clinical skill set to be able to do endo. Which I know is not, I know that's not true. I mean, I know you. I mean, I wouldn't even be friends with you if I didn't think you were good. Okay. So I mean, I don't hang out with losers. Right. So, but does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense.
All right. Yes. So what else do you want your associate to do?
Wisdom teeth extractions.
Okay. So this is a good one. Okay.
However, let me explain this. I just recently brought in a traveling
oral surgeon.
GP. No, he's not even it's not oral surgeon. It's a traveling general dentist. He wants to be a full-time traveling dentist providing oral surgery services.
Okay, so great. Unless you're horrible at wisdom teeth like me, I would say that's another procedure that you don't want to give to your associate from a pure business perspective, okay?
Yeah.
But I'll buy into the wisdom teeth because that to me is scary. But that's just me. My friends and I know Howard Ferran and all these guys say wisdom teeth are fun and easy. But okay, so now you want somebody to help you do wisdom teeth. Okay. What else do you look for an associate for?
If they're good with children, that'll be great as well. I mean, not that we see a lot of children. I would say less than 5.
No, you don't see children because I can tell you don't like seeing them.
So our practice has less than 5% kids.
They might be grandkids. Are you counting grandkids?
Yeah, I'm counting the grandkids.
Okay.
In the practice.
All right. So, okay, children, that's fine. I'm not a big believer in children in the practice anyway, but it helps you grow a family practice if that's your ultimate goal.
But that's not a big.
Okay, it's way down on the list.
Yeah. It's not a deal breaker for me.
All right. So endo, wisdom teeth, what else do you need your associate to be able to do?
I guess this is a non-clinical thing I'm looking for. Someone's a good communicator.
Okay.
So obviously true in planning.
So don't hire anybody that's less than 2 or 3 years out of school.
I mean, I guess it depends. I mean, if they're trainable, I mean, I think there are people who graduate who are just naturally good at communicating.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I would say for the most part, that's a learned art as well. So it may have to be someone with at least 2 years of experience. But I do have some fears about hiring an associate, which I think maybe you'll cover here shortly.
All right. What are your fears?
Just number one is, you know, finding the person who has a similar clinical philosophy. Obviously, you know, you don't want to run into something where the associate is overly aggressive, where it makes, you know, where patients feel like they're aggressive, or where they're way too conservative, where it makes the owner doctor look like they're aggressive. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two is someone who is clinically competent. That mm-hmm. way that I'm not having to redo dentistry every time I do a hygiene check on a patient that they've seen. Number three is finding someone who has skin in the game, you know, who is willing to be committed to the practice, to treat the practice as if it's their own. And I understand that's probably has to do something with structuring their pay and if it's leading to buy-in or whatnot, so sweat equity or whatever. One of the other things is speed. And one of the other things I think you mentioned earlier is finding someone who the associate is going to be a part-time position. And, you know, part-time positions come in many different forms. And when I was working as an associate dentist prior to my practice, I was working 4 days a week for the dentist I was working for. But on the Fridays, I was working at a corporation. And I only did that because I was younger at the time and I wanted to, you know, pay off some debt, you know, work hard since I was young. The trouble that we were having at that corporation that I was associate 1 day a week was new patients would come into my schedule on that 1 day. And then we would try to keep the continuity.
Yeah, it's hard.
Treatment to be done by me, but it's hard because the patients don't want to come back that same day again. They want to come back on a Tuesday or a Monday
yeah.
and not a Friday. So that's another hurdle is if I hire an associate, I would have to hire someone maybe 2 or 3 days a week. And so is that, do a lot of people just bite the bullet, I guess, and hire someone more days than is offered or more days than they can handle?
All good questions. So would you like your cake with that, all of that too?
So these are all thoughts I've had. I've been thinking about for this podcast. But
so all right, so let me give you an analogy to your questions, okay? And I am the master of not being able to do associates right, okay? So I remember when we were having one of our house built, and they were pouring the driveway, and I asked my contractor, "So what's the guarantee on the concrete?" And you know what he said to me?
What was that?
He says, "I guarantee you it will crack." Okay, so I guarantee you with associates, with yourself, with anybody, all of your fears are going to happen. I guarantee you that you're going to have to redo dentistry. I guarantee you're going to have somebody that's more aggressive or somebody that's not aggressive enough. I guarantee you're going to have somebody that doesn't communicate well. I guarantee you all of those things because, quite honestly, what we all look for is someone perfect or someone like us. And quite honestly, you don't want anybody like yourself to a certain degree because you'll clash, you won't get along. And I always look at it this way, unless you're trying to give into partnership. If you found somebody that was just like you and motivated and all those things, why in the hell would they stick around? You know, that that person probably wants to open their own practice. Some of those things are going to be challenges that are going to happen. So you have to go into it expecting it to happen. It's like when you started implant dentistry, did you want any implants to fail?
No.
No, but do you have failures?
Yeah, we've had a couple.
Okay, right. So it happens, right? So if you've had a couple of failures, that means you're not doing hundreds, you know, because you're going to have failures, right? It's just, you know, statistically, it's part of the game. So all of those fears are going to happen. What has to happen is learn from my mistakes. You've got to invest time in your associate. You've got to have clear directions on what it is you want them to do, what that looks like, you know, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. You've got to do things that are almost dental schoolish in a way. And I learned this when I was shadowing with Pacific Dental for a while, is when they have any new person, whether I joined them or whether somebody straight out of school joined them, is that most of their owners require post-op x-rays of fillings and crowns and everything until you can prove that your work is good. Because to see some of those things 6 months later or a year later or 9 months later, it's too late, right? Mm-hmm. You want to catch those things when they happen. So, you know, some of those things are things that you probably won't want to do, but you're going to need to do. Mm-hmm. So be prepared for that as well.
Yeah.
So, and barring a diamond in the rough, you know, find somebody that has a clinical skill set that you have is going to be tough. And the other thing you have to do is you have to spend time calibrating yourselves because, you know, are you the same dentist you were 8 years ago?
Probably not.
No, I hope not. Probably not. I'm sure you're not, right? So you can't expect somebody to come in and advance 7 or 8 years that quickly. So you've got to be prepared for some of that as well. So, you know, there's no easy answer to that, but you know that's something that you're going to have to get prepared for. So, what else is on your mind?
Well, I mean, that's the main thing is just managing growth of the practice in the ways of, you know, what you said, possibly.
Why do you want to grow?
Why do I want to grow?
Or define what growth means to you.
I think for me personally, growth means that I'll be able to spend more time doing what I love, which is, professionally speaking, doing the dentistry that I love, as I mentioned.
But what is the dentistry that you love? So you want to do more CEREC?
More CEREC, more implants, less fillings.
Okay. You know, but yet you want your associate to do the endo so you can keep doing fillings.
He can do endo and fillings. And then the other thing, just personally, being able to kind of like yourself, get to a point where I can take more time off. So right now, I average probably about 3 to 4 weeks of time off per year. But I love to take, it'd be nice if I can take another week or two.
Week or two, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then also, do a little more teaching. You know, I'm not some sort of a national speaker or anything like that, and I don't intend to be.
Don't say that. You intend to be and you will be. Because otherwise, what's the point of even doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the type of opportunities given.
Yeah,
but right now I'm starting just locally doing some over-the-shoulder events, some live surgery events, doing some of the trainings for Patterson and some of the manufacturers. So I love to do more of that because I do enjoy teaching. I wish there was a dental school in Tucson, and I'd love to, go out there. But the closest dental school is in Phoenix.
I'm going to keep coming back to consider dropping some insurance. And thinning out your practice a little bit. Because here's what you did not say to me. You did not say that growth to you is more money.
I guess financial.
But it's not the important thing to you.
Yeah, it's not the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, listen, nobody wants to do all of this stuff for no more money, okay? I mean, yeah. I get that, okay? But I totally let you talk there. And not once did you say, I want to make more money. I need more money or any of that stuff. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying it's telling, okay, what it tells me.
I'd love to pay off debt faster if I could.
Okay, great. I mean, and that's fine, okay? But that's still not what you said first and second even, or third.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so that tells me that of the three, remember I said people are after money, time, or satisfaction. You're past the money stage. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're comfortable there, okay? You're secure there. That doesn't mean you've paid off everything. That doesn't mean that you're wealthy. That doesn't mean that you have enough money to retire. It just means mm-hmm. that you've reached that point where you're no longer worried, am I going to have food on the table and is my practice going to close down? Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're moving into the time and satisfaction realm. Okay. The killer of time and satisfaction is growth with no financial reward. Okay, so when you grow, you're not always going to make more money. I'll give you an example, okay? I made the most money personally, okay, 2 years ago, and we produced less than we did last year. And we've grown, okay? But that growth hasn't brought me more financial money, mm-hmm. okay? So I think outside of large group environments where we have business team members and multiple partners, I think to a certain degree, people like you and I who have interest in teaching and doing other things and interest in growing clinically, where we're driven by some of that, I think it's hard to continue to take as many insurances as you're taking because it's just going to overrun your practice with fillings. Or the other thing that you can do is you can start blocking less fillings into your schedule and start booking fillings out months.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we're doing right now, to manage fillings.
So the just because you have a filling doesn't mean I got to see you right away. I mean, I got patients that need root canals. I got to see right away. I got patients that need teeth taken out that need to, I need to be see right away, you know? So you're going to have to start blocking it to where you get farther along. So have I answered some of your associate questions there?
Yeah, that was great.
Well, so the other thing was, where do you look for one? I've been lucky. I've always found my associates through my dental rep. I've relied on my local branch of Patterson here, and Chuck, who is technically a co-host of this podcast, yet he hasn't been on in months. But, you know, I've been fortunate to find people through them. And in fact, I actually make him, I ask him to phone meet or physically meet people before I bring them in, just because, you know, I would say in your situation, your rep knows you probably better than, you know, what they know you very well and what you're looking for. And they can give an objective perspective of what would fit well in your practice and what wouldn't fit well in your practice.
I was also considering asking my referring specialists, because, you know, they know the type of dentistry I do. They know my personality. You know, they're the guys in our Spear Study Club. So just keeping an eye out for potentially any candidates for associateship.
You know, the one thing that you may have an advantage of in Arizona is, and we're starting to see that here in North Carolina as well, is you may start getting a lot of people that are moving to Arizona to quote-unquote semi-retire. So you may be able to actually get dentists that are semi-retiring in your area to bring them on in a part-time or full-time basis. People that are tired of the rat race wherever they were living and want to move there, where, you know, that doesn't exist in every market.
Yeah. With your previous associates and your current associates.
All five of them.
Are you doing everything yourself? Or do you use a consulting firm, a transition like group, to help you create the contracts and pay structure? I mean, all that kind of stuff. Is that just something you learned along the way?
No, it's trial and error. All right. My advice is probably not reasonable in this area. Okay. So the pay structure is pretty simple to me. Okay. You give them a minimal guarantee as a draw, and then you pay them a percentage of collections. So the pay structure should be pretty simple, okay? That percentage will be based on your area and the type of dentistry the person does. And if it's outside of norm, I would start them at norm with the ability to get to non-norm. So in other words, let's just say I moved to your area, okay? Mm-hmm. And I decided, hey, I'm going to go be an associate for John Yu, okay? And I'm going to say, you know what? For someone like me, what is the norm in your area? What were you getting paid as an associate? 30%?
No, I was just getting paid hourly.
Okay. But let's say normally, maybe let's use the number 30%.
I'll say the normal out here is going to be around 28 to 30%.
Okay. So let's call it 30% for easy math. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's say I came to John Yu and I said, John, I think I can do some great things for your practice. I want 40%. Okay. I'm worth it. Okay. That's just me being a little bit of an ass. Okay. But I'm worth it. Okay. But I wouldn't start me at 40%. I would make me to prove it. And me, I would be accepting of that. You know, as long as it's in writing that as long as I meet these criteria, I'll get it. You know, that's how I would look at it. The pay is the easy part. Now, when it comes to contracts, against all advice, I've never done a contract with any of my associates.
So what if something happens where your associate goes to an attorney?
They're going to go to an attorney to do what?
Just pay or just...
Pay. Okay, so we've had agreements, okay? So we have written out where how I'm going to pay them. And I pretty much just pay people the way I tell them I'm going to pay them.
And then with your associates, is it just strictly associateship, or do you mention to them also, hey, this can lead to buy-in or partnership?
Right now, I am open-minded. But I don't even entertain partnership with anybody right now. I mean, if somebody says, hey, I only want to come here if I can be partner, I say, then don't come here. Okay. I'm not saying it won't happen or couldn't happen. I'm just saying if you're going to come in with that's that level, what's important to you, then I'm probably not the right place. is really what it boils down to. Okay. So that's pretty clear for me in that sense. And I think most people after hanging out with me for 4 or 5 months don't want to be my partner, quite honestly.
But wouldn't you say that it would be nice to have an associate who's going to be there long term, but that they'll want to be there long term because there's something in it for them?
There is something in it for them. It's called a paycheck. It's called the ability to learn.
But why not go do my own thing?
Great. Go spend $1 million and do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's one of my worries.
Like, I don't even have a non-compete with my associates. Again, against all advice, okay?
Yeah,
No one in their right mind agrees with me, okay? So I just don't believe in that. Because I literally tell people, if you would like to open up next door, go for it. And it's not egotistically saying my patients won't leave. I'm just saying, fine. It's okay. It's fine. Mm-hmm. It's not something I'm overly worried about. So, you know, it's I'm not... Again, against advice. I think the pay is the easy part. I personally think at your stage, because you're still young and you're still in your growth phase, I think going into it, trying to say you want somebody that wants to be a partner, it's premature. It's like going on a first date and saying, I don't want to go on a date with you unless you're ready to get married.
Yeah.
You know, it's impossible. Like literally, if I came to you, John, I mean, I pretend I'm a female, good-looking one, and I said, John, I want to go on a date with you, but I don't want to go out unless you think you want to get married. I mean, how would you respond to that?
I mean, it'd be a little strange, but I mean, I guess a lot of people date to hopefully get married.
Okay, that's fine. So that's fine. I'm not guaranteeing I'm going to get married.
I mean, I wouldn't verbally say that or have hopefully that person.
But that's what you're asking for, right? I mean, in a sense, like what guarantees is that person that's looking for partnership have? I mean, here's what I think again, and I'm not the right person. I keep saying this over and over again. I'm just giving you my perspective. I think when you tell somebody that you have a potential to lead to partnership, I think if it doesn't actually get to that point quicker than later, it creates resentment and creates problems in the relationship.
Got it. Yeah.
You know, that's my belief. And I would be careful with that.
I mean, there's a lot of different philosophies out there, obviously.
Yeah, of course. And mine is always the right one, of course. So what else you got on your mind, dude? Oh, we got to talk about sleep real quick. Let's spend 5-10 minutes talking about sleep. So sleep is new to you. How's that been going?
It's been going great. I mean, since I took the class, it was that mid-November.
Yeah.
Didn't really have much time to implement it, to take advantage of people's deductibles and insurances for the end of the year benefits.
That's because you're too busy doing fillings.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of MODs. I love those Garrison bands and the Paladin bands. Those are my favorite things in my office. But this year, you know, we've incorporated the stop bang questionnaire.
Need the Epworth because insurance companies are going to request that.
Yes, okay. Epworth as well.
Okay.
I've given the home sleep test to a couple of people, one of them being my Patterson rep.
Mm-hmm.
So he was my number one patient for right now just because he knew this is what I was getting into. So we coordinated. He had an actual sleep study back in May at a sleep study center. His AHI was 45, but he's lost about 30 pounds since. And he's worn his CPAP since June. But it's when he wakes up in the morning, it's always on the ground. So he's wanting to find an alternative. So we scanned him just to kind of, you know, obviously just evaluate airway, just for screening wise. And then I sent him home with the home sleep test. And when I got the same one that we used at the course. Made by Junior. So we plugged that in the next day and his AHI was at about 29.7, I believe.
Okay, so better, but still in the mild, so high moderate, you know, so almost right now, severe, essentially.
So the next step for me is to submit his report to a medical doctor. So I'm going to use that.
The physician services, okay.
Yes, the physician services that Aaron uses. And once I get the report back, just confirming, and then hopefully we can fabricate him a sleep appliance or the OptiSleep.
Well, technically you can fabricate a sleep appliance without all that stuff. You just need that stuff to get insurance reimbursement.
Yes. But, I'll only get paid for my time.
So have you, what else have you implemented from the sleep? What are you doing to create awareness in the practice?
Yes, that's a very good question. So with the questionnaire and all that we do, if we know this with a new patient. So with the new patients, we've probably had about 10 patients who have answered the questions in a way where, you know, it draws my attention. So then just creating awareness by asking them questions about if they've had a sleep test before in the past, if they have worn a sleep appliance, or if they currently or have worn a CPAP. So just kind of hearing their feedback about their
what kind of responses are you getting to that?
Well, definitely with CPAPs, I have not heard a single person. Well, actually, I take that back. There's one person who loves a CPAP. He's worn it for 20 years.
No, but how many people are wearing CPAPs or have been prescribed a CPAP?
Well, out of those 10 people, I would say six of them are wearing their CPAP. Five of the six hate it. The one guy likes it. But the other guys have not worn it, and they know they have sleep apnea.
Okay.
So it's a so I know.
So that's 10 people, by the way. That's $30,000.
Yeah, that's 10 people in the first month.
That's, let's call it even 20 grand.
Yeah.
I mean, huge. Yeah, so just get rid of some insurances, stop doing fillings, and you'll make the same amount of money and you'll work less.
But yeah, you know, you're absolutely right in the sense with the sleep, creating awareness. You know, we do where we ask the patient to hold their breath with us for 10
seconds. That's great, isn't it?
That's phenomenal. I mean, patients realize, wow, like, that's hard to do.
That's horrible.
You know, awake. So when you're sleeping and I'm doing that, you know, that they're doing that, you know, they find that very serious. I mean, it creates that urgency. Hey, this is dangerous. And, you know, just bringing up examples too of, you know, Reggie White and some of the accidents recently.
Antonin Scalia for your Republican patients. Kind of stuff, so. Don't do that to liberals. Liberals will be like, good that he died, you know?
So, yeah, so creating the awareness has been great. And been
10 patients in a month. That's awesome.
Once we create the awareness, then we take a scan of the patient just to see what their airway looks like. And just a disclaimer, obviously.
Obviously, we know that has no diagnostic value, right?
Yeah, no diagnostic value. So we just take the scan just to check and then.
If nothing, it's a great visual communication tool.
Yeah, it's a great visual communication. And
it's a great conversation starter.
Yeah. And I always let the patient know, all because you see a constriction here doesn't necessarily mean that you do have sleep apnea. And all because you see all open airway here doesn't mean that you don't have sleep apnea. So, it's just a great conversation starter, like you said.
Yeah.
And then we just hopefully home sleep test. And right now we're kind of working out the kinks with Hutan's company code just regarding eligibility checks, pre-authorizations. And
yeah, December's a tough month for all companies. They can't, you know, it's just crazy the number of patients you get through and all of that. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, so I know we're in January now, but, you know.
So it's been good. And I've kind of, with those 10 patients, I've also asked them, is finances a concern or is time a concern? And, you know, some of them are really excited to just move forward, you know, once we figure out how much the cost is. But, you know, some of these guys, you know, they said the cost is concerned. They want to get their deductible down. So we've kind of asked them. Hey,
so you're creating that book of business?
Exactly. We're doing that funnel list, the patient funnel list.
Yeah, it's amazing how many. That's good. I'm glad. I mean, it makes me feel good that you're implementing so much of what we talked about in the program.
Yeah.
So that's good. I mean, so I was going to continue to ask you some stuff on the sleep. So let me ask you this. Have you started going out to physicians and nurturing relationships and things like that?
I have not actively done that just yet. I mean, that's something it's on my to-do list. And I do have a couple of ENT buddies here in town. They work together. They have a clinic. So we hang out here and there. So I'm going to talk to them about the services because we've talked about sleep apnea in the past.
So, okay. So it's a trick question, John. Okay. Yeah. So where in the world are you going to find time to do all this?
Yeah, that's, you're absolutely right. So maybe I need to have my sleep champion do it now.
No, but beyond that, I mean, it's your sleep champion can't create those relationships.
That's true.
Okay. So
yeah,
I can't get people to understand the opportunity cost of fillings. Fillings crush practices. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in my opinion, single unit crowns at some point crush practices. At some point, you have to get past even that growth phase where those things are, in a sense, beneath you, okay? Or those things are holding you back, right? And I'm telling you, I promise you this. If you cut, and you're working 4 days a week, right?
4 days a week.
I need you to cut down to 3 days a week. You're looking at me like I'm crazy, aren't you?
Sort of, kind of.
I know, but you need to. You need to be in the chair the equivalent of 3 days a week, and you need to be out of your chair the equivalent of 1 day a week, because you've got to go out and create relationships. You've got to lead your team. You've done a great job and you're doing a great job, but you've now to go to the level that you just said that was important to you. more implants, more CEREC dentistry, more complex dentistry. You've got to lead and communicate more. I mean, I'm not saying better, like as if it's bad. You just got to take it to another level. And you cannot take it to another level working 4 days a week. I'm just telling you, you cannot. And in fact, for what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to cut down from 3 days a week to a little bit less than 3 days a week so that I can take my stuff to the next level that I want to go to. And especially if you're going to be interested in doing more education, because you said doing more education was also one of your goals, right?
Yeah.
So as soon as that starts taking off and now your Fridays, Thursdays are filled with travel, how in the world are you going to travel to do any of this stuff? Mm-hmm. If you got, you know, if your practice is there. So really you have got to not wait till the time is necessary. You got to, one of the things, Phil, business-wise, I believe in is if you add per people when you absolutely have to do it, it's too late. That's reactionary. You want to be proactive in all of this. And the same thing with bringing an associate and maybe dropping some insurance and maybe doing both of those at the same time. You've kind of got to be proactive in all of that.
Yeah.
You got anything else for me? So the sleep is working out good. The class was good for you. That's good to hear. So yeah, that's good. What else you got for me? Anything else we missed on my list here?
I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, it's time to go to bed for everybody. So
I guess next time we can talk about block scheduling.
Are you doing that well? Are you happy with that? Because
yeah,
we suck. I understand it conceptually unbelievably well. Our team just blows at it. I mean, they suck. They suck at block scheduling. I mean, it's just like they have this fear of saying no to people. And listen, I'm no better. I can just tell patients I don't do it, right? I just tell I can just pawn that off on somebody else. So it's so easy for me to say, just you guys got to be saying no, but I'm not the one looking at the patient. Yeah. Block scheduling is important.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a part two on block scheduling because I think it'd be nice to hear sort of some of the way that, I guess, some ways that other people do it or how you do it versus how we do it.
I can tell you how I theoretically want it to be done. I'm not saying how it's getting done. I mean, block scheduling in a way is working backwards.
Of course.
Right? It's designing your ideal day and then working backwards. And you got to have a sense of reality and a sense of dream in that. Does that make sense? The reality is that, like, oh, I want a block schedule where all I do are implants all day long. Mm-hmm. Right? But the reality is I don't have the business to do that.
Yeah.
So it's part reality and part dreams. And part of blocking is blocking out holes. Remember I said Swiss cheese to have a place to put things. I did a podcast on implementing new procedures into your practice. That was probably mid last year. That's probably like episode somewhere in the first 10 or 12 episodes of the podcast. And really it talks about initially when I bring in new procedures, I set aside a day, a special day for that. So like, for example, my day off is Thursday and Friday. So if I were to be like, we're getting ready to learn how to do some soft tissue grafting and start adding that into the practice. So when that comes in, I'll book out one Thursday a month where all I'll do, I won't try to do soft tissue grafting in my regular schedule. I'll only do it on Thursdays until we get our workflow and understanding and until it becomes a commonplace procedure for us. Then I'll introduce it into Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays. So that's kind of how I handle, like when that's I did implants.
That's a good way to incorporate new procedures. And
yeah, because they take longer. You don't know what the hell you're doing. Your team doesn't know what in the world you're doing. You don't, you know, always have the right instruments. You got to go back and forth to get those things. So, you know, those are things that I believe until they become like the analogy, how I try to explain it to people is if a patient walked in and needed a filling, you guys could on drop of a hat, know exactly how to do a filling, correct? Mm-hmm. Everybody could make a crown, whatever it is, right? I mean, it's so commonplace. And until newer procedures become like that, in the sense of, hey, we can on a dime, we can stop, drop, figure out what we got to have the equipment out and convert it into that procedure. Until you can get that, you need to do it on non-regular days. And so that's how I bring in new procedures. When we did implants, I did implants on Thursdays and Fridays. Actually, when we did implants, I was working 4 days a week. So I did those on Fridays. So I was doing implant dentistry on Fridays back then. you know, now implants are an everyday procedure for us. I mean, yeah. We're doing it every day, but we can do it every day. We don't have a special time set aside for those now. And then the other thing with blocks is I don't try to block procedures. I try to block by length. So we have what I call my 2-hour blocks. We have my, my half morning blocks or all morning blocks. And then we have our 1-hour blocks. So that way, you know, we can block in based on procedure time and not just dollar amounts, because there are certain things, unfortunately, that we do that I know are going to take longer or less time. It may or may not produce more or less, but that way we have the time blocking going on there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the kind of things. And the other area that I think we neglect for blocks is hygiene. I think one of the reasons that my office and many other offices struggle with perio numbers is we don't block the time for perio. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, I believe if you see an empty hole in your schedule and you keep seeing, hey, I'm not hitting my perio, after time, your team members, good team members, will find a way to fill that schedule with what you're supposed to fill it with. So that's kind of me. So I'd love to spend more time. I like interviewing you. You ask me questions. That's the best. All right, John, how do people get in touch with you?
The best way to contact me is via email,
which is johnsuyu, not y-o-u, okay, dds@gmail.com. Again, that's johnsuyu, dds@gmail.com. Dr. John Yu, Tucson, Arizona. John, I think you're also a CEREC doctor's guy.
That is correct.
Okay, so they can always, for CEREC and cone beam owners, they can find you on the CEREC Doctors Board, and you are also on Facebook. So John Yu on Facebook as well. So John, thank you so much for taking time away from your family to spend time with us. And for all our listeners out there, thank you for spending time listening to the podcast. If you could do me a favor, I really want to make 2017 a greater year for the podcast. So if you could take an opportunity to introduce the podcast to your friends, and then if you could take an opportunity, if you want to learn more on business and workshops and sleep apnea and how to use a CEREC and cone beam and all those things, consider looking at our workshops at 3d-dentist.com. Again, John, thank you very much. And
thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to T-Bone Speaks with Dr. Tarun Agarwal. Remember to keep striving for excellence, and we'll catch you on the next episode.